It's not just on this program that death is a more frequent topic of discussion these days. We didn't invent concepts like the death cafe, the places where people gather to talk openly about death. At some point, we need to consider how we want things to go when we die. Otherwise, it's possible we'll end up in a hospital bed with machines keeping us alive until our loved ones say it's time. Dr. Samuel Harrington, an MD, urges a look ahead in his book At Peace, subtitled Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Dr. Harrington had specialties in internal medicine and gastroenterology. He left clinical practice a few years ago, writing a blog with wife Debbie Weil on taking a gap year after age 60. And Dr. Harrington's been focused on healthcare reform at the very time the whole country turned its attention to that very issue as well. Samuel Harrington, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeff, thank you very much for having me. Please call me Sam, and consider the fact that I've trained for this moment by doing colonoscopies for 35 years. So I'm looking forward to something else.
I fully understand. So your own father made you think very hard about end-of-life issues. Give us a starter conversation about that.
Well, yes, he is sort of the inspiration for the book, because I was tossing around the idea of writing a book on this subject, but it didn't crystallize until I had a conversation with him when we were discussing treatment options for an aortic aneurysm in his abdomen, and that's a balloon blood vessel that was threatening to rupture, and if it ruptured, he would die. So, of course, I wanted to encourage him to think about treatment options, some of which were good, some of which were bad, and he looked at me and he said, why would I want to fix something that's going to carry me away the way that I want to go? And I was sort of taken aback. But it opened up, that was his vision, and that's what the book is about. It's about having a vision of how you want your life to end, or how what you can do to make that vision come true, so to speak, with the understanding that our visions like his are naive, and we don't always get what we want, and but it's still a goal worth working toward.
Well, you're very clear about that in the book. You say this is not about making the end of life good. So what really are we trying to clear up here?
Well, nobody's vision of the end of their life would be the same, but the attributes, the good characteristics, or the characteristics of a good death have been well studied. And so sort of striving for those is my goal. And the five most common most important attributes of a good death are control, comfort, closure, affirmation, and trust. And control is the idea that a patient has some influence on the decision-making process, indeed makes the decisions. Comfort, of course, is the absence of pain. Closure is the opportunity to have the time and space to reconcile with family and friends. Affirmation is to be validated as a person and to have your values as a person appreciated. And then trust is the environment which a patient is surrounded with, trusted caregivers, the comforts of home or a home-like environment. So those are the attributes of a good death that, in a sense, I'm promoting. But if we look at the reverse of each one of those values, if we flip control to helplessness and flip comfort to pain and closure to isolation and affirmation to denial and trust to frustration, well, then you've pretty well defined a medicalized death in an intensive care unit, which is what I would have encouraged my parents to avoid, and indeed they did.
Well, and why do so many people, though, and both my parents ended up medicalized death in intensive care units, and I don't think thought that that was what they would have wanted either, but it happened anyway. I mean, how does that often become the case?
Well, there are a lot of factors in that. There's the momentum to treat, which I'll try and get back to, but the biggest factor is that people don't express themselves in advance or far enough in advance to prevent getting sort of sucked onto the conveyor belt of medical treatment, which is a good conveyor belt under many circumstances, but really doesn't always serve the elderly patient well. So that's part of the momentum to treat, but you have to keep in mind that most elderly patients, when asked, would prefer to die at home. and yet it is fundamental to die at home, to make the decision to say no to medical care, to say no to, at least to hospitalization. And that's pretty much what the book is about. It's about seeing a point where one should say no thank you to medical treatments.
Well, you do recommend being aggressively passive, which is a really interesting phrase. Could you unpack that for us a bit?
Well, yeah, I think people saying no has a passivity to it, a declining treatment, but you have to be aggressive about it to get past what doctors will tell you, what the momentum of treatment will force on you, what the system in a hospital will put you through. Because if you're in a hospital, you will do what the you will be subject to what the rules and regulations and the systems that the hospital applies. So you will be moved from here to there. You will have this X-ray to before you have that test, before you have this treatment, and you have to really sort of break free of that by being aggressive about saying no and saying no to this and no to that, and then saying no to further hospitalization and getting home. So it's you it's not you can't sit back and let things happen. You have to take control.
All right, so it is saying no, but it's saying no and being very assertive about it anyway to make sure that your needs are understood. Sam Harrington's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Dr. Samuel Harrington, the author of At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Lots of steps in the process that we can talk about and will as the minutes go by. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the approach, and you can join the conversation as well by phone or by email. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Samuel Harrington and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Samuel Harrington, retired from clinical practice after many years of colonoscopies and other work with patients. He is thinking ahead to the end of life and how we can all do a little thinking ahead to the end of life and figure out how it is that we would like to go. What sorts of conditions? This is not an assisted suicide sort of book, but really just about the conditions in which we would like to pass from this earth and what should happen. His book is called At Peace, subtitled Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. There are three distinct parts to the book, Sam, Limits and Failures of American Medicine in Part 1, Part 2, Understanding Disease, Part 3, Practical Aspects of Planning for Your Death. Let me jump ahead for just a moment to that title, because for most people, does planning and death just not compute?
That is correct. For most people, they don't look ahead, and then and in addition to that, the generation, the boomer generation that is moving into the old age demographic at this point has really been subjected to, and I'm in that category as I'm a boomer myself, we've been subjected to a lot of media influence about disease, health. You know, we're obsessed with youth. We think we're going to live forever. We want to be vigorous right up to the end. There is an old medical aphorism that it is a doctor's role to help patients die young, as late in life as possible. And so that resonates with our idea that we want to be vigorous right up to the end. So we don't really make plans or we don't think about it. But that aphorism belies the fact that if we are lucky enough to live into old age, we will become debilitated, we will get weak and frail, and we will need help with our lives and help with our deaths. And we need to have a plan so that some of our desires come to pass.
All right. That is, again, the whole point, is that thinking ahead to the very end, which is not a pleasant thing for sure. I mean, you know, the idea of visualizing life without us actually being in it is is a tricky thing. So let's come back then to the limits and failures of American medicine and back to the example of your father. How well did he die?
Well, he didn't die the way he wanted, but he died peacefully and at home, and that is, in the broadest sense, that was a good death. Now, nobody's death is serene and quiet in the sense that they're lying under a shroud with candles burning and music playing and everybody's happy. I mean, I shouldn't say nobody. That is what some people visualize, but there will be active dying. People jerk and grunt and make noises when they're dying, so it's not always serene and lovely. He had wanted to die quickly, and that did not come to pass. Instead, he did, in fact, dwindle into old age, which he had hoped to avoid. But by the same token, that gave his family an opportunity to, as I say, bring things to closure, to spend time with him, to enjoy many aspects of the last couple of years. And if I can go back to the idea of treating his aneurysm for a minute, when he was told about his aneurysm initially, we talked him into one of the treatments so that he would live long enough to meet some great-grandchildren, etc. But when his aneurysm was re-expanding about a year and a half before he died, he was told that he had to have the treatment again, and at that point he picked up the telephone and called all his doctors and canceled all his appointments and said, thank you very much, but I will be disengaging from medical care at this point. So he did everything he could to allow that to happen. It just didn't occur as he wanted.
Sorry, but he did live to, what, 94, was it?
He was about 1 month shy of 94, yes.
Wow. So we've mentioned the medicalization of death, the fact that so many people do die in the ICU with all kinds of tubes and wires and all that stuff. The bigger question I'm interested in is why? I mean, who is helped by the medicalization of death?
Well, the system is helped, and the system is not designed to help people get out of the system, so to speak. We, our default position, doctors, including myself, our default position is to treat. And it would be the very rare doctor who would say, oh, we shouldn't treat you. It's the more common to say, well, let's give this a try. And when we start giving things a try, we start moving the momentum to treat forward, and it keeps going. We keep doubling down on our treatments. So the system is built to treat. The system is, you make money from treating. You use technology by treating. You expand horizons a little bit by treating, but that works against the elderly in a major way. So let me sort of go back to an analogy between where comparing doctors with generals on a war footing. A general on a war footing wants to address the enemy with overwhelming force, and that's appropriate. And when a doctor approaches a treatable disease or a young patient, overwhelming force is appropriate. But it becomes less appropriate when old age and dying of or dying with old age are a factor, because that's a special circumstance. And dying with old age is not a battle that can be won, so we have to kind of rejigger our thinking around that. And it's easier to see when appropriate treatment moves into excessive treatment and then into futile treatment when the patient is elderly than when a patient is young. And I maintain that futile treatment is always cruel and morally wrong. It's simply hard to identify in advance. But I think it's easy to identify retrospectively, in the sense that if you as an onlooker, a family member, reflects on the care that one's loved one received, the last aggressive care they received as they were dying, and says to themselves, I wish I hadn't done that to my mother, well, that's the definition of futile care in my mind. And with experience, an experienced doctor can sort of recognize that in advance. And my goal is to get patients to try and recognize it, and doctors to not to recognize it and act on it, and say that to that patient and their family, I wouldn't do this to my mother, and I think you should reconsider this treatment request.
Dr. Samuel Harrington is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Let's talk about doctors and healthcare systems. And I want to get to one of the general observations you make in this first part of the book, that healthcare costs almost twice as much in this country as any other country, but with poorer outcomes. I'm, again, interested in more the size. Or why do relatively few members of the American public understand this?
Well, because we believe in our healthcare system. We are educated to believe in it by the media and by the medical industrial complex, so to speak. I know I sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but I'm not. It's 20% of our gross national product, and it's hard to slow it down. People who are making a profit at it don't want to stop and reflect on what they're doing, and we just keep going. These big systems like the Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Harvard systems, I'm sure there are clinics out on the West Coast that are comparable, with which I'm not familiar, but big systems don't compete based on the quality of care they deliver, because all their quality is so good in the sense they can't make it any better. They're spending a lot of money on that, and we can't make it better, because they're all fairly comparable, so they compete with in another way to capture patients. And the other way that they compete is by investing in technology, investing in new buildings with better amenities. So this all takes money, and it's just part of a big kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is what you call assembly line care in the book. I'm intrigued by the idea of medical providers developing product lines, basically.
Well, yeah, in the book I comment on the fact that many institutions will specialize in what we in the administration call a product line. That is to say, oh, we've got a lot of good orthopedic surgeons, let's specialize in joint replacement. Oh, we've got a lot of good oncologists, let's specialize in cancer treatment. And then, or we've got cardiologists, let's specialize in congestive heart failure. And then protocols are established. People are hired to facilitate moving patients into and through and out of the system to get economies of scale, because they get more patients in, safer, faster, et cetera. But like re-engineering a highway for to be safer, people don't slow down on a re-engineered highway. They drive faster to see what they can get away with. Well, doctors in an effective system, oh, well, we got that 90-year-old patient through. Maybe we can get this 91-year-old patient through. And we feed the system without reflecting on the patient so much as the system.
We were talking to Dr. Samuel Harrington, who is an internal medicine specialist and gastroenterologist, has been out of clinical practice for a few years. He took a gap year after age 60 and wrote a blog about it with his wife, Debbie Weil. He's also written a book for all of us to use to think about how we would like the conditions to be at the end of our lives, where we'd like to be, with whom, and all those sorts of things. The book is called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange with Sam Harrington.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Great topic. I wish more people would pay attention to. I haven't read your book, so I was wondering if you dealt with the concept of advocacy in the book, especially toward the end of life, but also valuable any time a person is in a severe disease situation, that having an individual or individuals that you can rely on to assist you in just simple things like doctor's visits, et cetera, take notes, and especially toward the end of life where there's serious decisions, to be able to be an advocate for what you have set out. I found in my own life as well as that of friends and relatives that it can be very difficult to buck heads with the system that says you must do this and this and this. And so that's where the advocate can be so helpful in giving you the strength, or if you have dementia or reduced abilities, to speak up for what you truly want.
Well, I do. I don't address advocacy head on the way you just described it, but it is of course a very important factor. I do deal with it in the sense of examples of the advocates that my father had and my mother during their dying processes. I was one of their advocates, particularly for my mother, in an unfortunate circumstance when the doctors did not get it right. And my father had a local nurse who ran a home health aid business and was his advocate in many meetings with his doctors. So it comes through clearly in the book, although I don't separate it out as a chapter or a topic.
All right, let's take another call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to The Exchange with Sam Harrington. Oops, Jamie's not there. All righty. So let me come back to some of the stuff we're talking about, the limits and failures of American medicine, the first part of the book. I almost laughed out loud at the chart that shows that 70 is the new 50, but 86 is the new 85.
Well, that's my shorthand way of comparing survival curves from 100 years ago with today, and another way of saying that we're effectively treating acute illnesses like pneumonia and appendicitis, but we're not really effectively curing chronic illnesses. So if you look back 100 years, people were dying at age 50 from tuberculosis or appendicitis, and now they're living into their 70s. But 100 years ago, people who were lucky enough to live to 85 were then dying of acute illnesses superimposed on chronic illnesses, and we haven't been able to treat the underlying chronic illnesses so effectively, so now those 85-year-olds are getting to live to be 86. Not such a big difference.
No. But so this is a huge question, I think. If you know you're not, and this is the generic you, if you know you're not in as good a shape as you'd like to be, but you also don't have any reason to think that death is close, I mean, how do you approach life?
Well, you need a reality check, it's very difficult to define old age because there's no arbitrary number that establishes it. The CDC studies Americans and clumps them by decades, so 45 to 55 year olds are clumped together, 55 to 65, but 65 to 105 are clumped together, and the CDC calls us old. Authors say 65 is the young old, 75 the middle old, 85 the old old. But I say you have to think of old age as a confluence of several factors. One is your disease. Another is your performance status, meaning that's medical gobbledygook for the ability to take care of yourself. Like if you can't feed yourself, if you can't bathe yourself, well, you're getting up in years, obviously. And then the other is just advancing age. So if your disease is advancing from stage one to stage four, if your performance status is declining and your age is advancing, when those three lines intersect, that's where you have to think of yourself as old enough that you factor age into your decision making when addressing the risk benefit ratio of a proposed treatment.
So in your own case, you were actually advising some of your patients against colonoscopies late in life?
Oh, absolutely. People would come to me, internists would routinely send patients for colonoscopies, and I would frame it up to them that, and this is not medical advice I'm trying to give over the radio, but I would frame it up to my patient in my office, who I knew for a long time. You know, the likelihood that you are going to die of colon cancer is 1 in 100, and the chance, if I do a colonoscopy, I'm going to push that out to 1 in 200. Do you want to spend 3 days getting ready for a colonoscopy and risk passing out while you're taking the preparation, or would you rather give me a buzz if symptoms develop? And the usual response was, oh, well, Dr. Harrington, if you frame it up that way, I'm going to go home and enjoy those 3 days, and I'll give you give you a call if something comes up.
And
so far, I haven't had to regret those recommendations.
That is good to know. You point out, though, that we're talking about when things are indicated for treatment and not. The median is the message, and I stress median, not medium. What do you mean?
What I mean by that is that when a diagnosis is made, we establish a prognosis, and generally a disease prognosis carries a median life expectancy, and some people think that they're going to beat the median, but I wrote about a very well-known essay written by a famous scientist where he did beat the median, but he was 49 years old at the time, and he lived 17 more years, or actually he was 42 and he lived 17 more years. The median is something that most elderly people will not beat. So I think that people, if they have a diagnosis with a median life expectancy, they should use that to make plans. If they can't will yourself as to where you're going to die or when, you can will yourself to get out of bed, you can will yourself to have more therapy, you can will yourself get out of bed after surgery.
Right, but you can't change the actual arrival of the date itself. So we'll talk about that on the other side of a break. At Peace is the book by Sam Harrington. Back in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about death in this hour. More than the incident itself, than about how we prepare for thinking ahead to death. We've talked about this with a bunch of other people, but Dr. Sam Harrington has been in the game for a long time in internal medicine and gastroenterology, and has watched people die and have watched people not die, or at least die in the way they wanted to. And that's the whole point, is figuring out what you can do to set up the best conditions in which you might, in fact, die at home in your own bed with loved ones around. His book is called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760 and by email jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of valuable stuff in the book, including in the segment about understanding disease. And that's where we're forced to confront the idea that after a while, our medical problems are old age. And I wonder, Sam, how hard it is for doctors to accept that.
Well, it's very hard for doctors to make recommendations to patients based on that. And I think when doctors become patients, they also have difficulties with that. Can I go back to the concept of the median for a moment?
Sure.
I think that it's best exemplified by my mother's situation when she was diagnosed with lung cancer. She was diagnosed with pneumonia. Then as the pneumonia was treated, it became clear that she had an underlying lung cancer. And after staging, that diagnosis was finalized at stage four lung cancer. Well, her prognosis was a median life expectancy of 10 months. But that's for a general population, and my mother was 82 at the time, and frail, meaning she was walking slowly, she was forgetful, she was weak, she had lost some weight, et cetera. So that's how we define frailty up to a certain point. And I knew that she would not be one of the people who lived longer than 10 months, especially if we treated her aggressively with chemotherapy that caused her appetite to fail and other factors. So we sat in her apartment, and she asked me what I thought, and I said the median life expectancy was 10 months. And she asked me, Sam, does that mean I'm going to die? And I said, yes, but I just don't know when. But the bubble over my head was saying I would say 6 to 9 months. And so we made decisions about how to treat her based on that understanding. And I did, in fact, tell her the median life expectancy was 10 months by explaining that if we had 100 people in the apartment, it would be very crowded. But in 10 months, half of them would have passed away. And we just don't know whether she'd be in the first half or the second half. And that's the idea of using a prognosis and a median to start making decisions, because she wanted to live long enough to see my my daughter get married, which was 3 to 4 months from the time of her diagnosis. And so we focused on that and didn't focus on other things.
And she made it to the wedding, didn't she?
She did. She made it to the wedding. It was a wonderful event. She was the center of some attention, and she made it home and died quietly about 4 months after that.
But I can see from that example, though, when you're thinking about medians and other and possible outcomes, that this is where people get stuck. It's like, okay, is this the time that we don't take mom or pop to the hospital, or do we go this time and think there will then be a next time we get to make this decision again?
Right, and we never want to think that there isn't going to be a next time, or we know that if we say no to medical treatment now, we're saying that there's not likely to be a next time. But I think it's very important for people to understand that when they start trading a good day at home for a day of isolation and treatment in a hospital or doctor's clinic or office, or when they start trading a good day at home for 2 days of side effects from treatment at home, or when they start trading a good day at home for, in fact, a complication of aggressive treatment, they've entered a zero-sum game. And when you're in that situation, it's simply better to enjoy the good day at home and not submit yourself to the isolation and frustration and complications of medical treatment.
Let's take a call here. We have John and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sam Harrington, the author of At Peace.
Hi. I think, Sam, I know I am on the older side, and I've now dealt with my older relatives, and I got a lot better at understanding how the system works and all, and what its momentum is, and I now know what I want, and I tell my kids that I know what I want. If there's an outlier kid, you know, who goes, well, we should try this. So how do I make sure that I have continuity in those who are going to be making the decisions when I can't? Because they all have to get educated again, and by the time all their relatives die, they'll understand the system. But the system itself, you know, is continuing to do this treatment thing. So how do I get them educated in advance?
All right. Thanks for that, John.
Well, it is having the conversation over and over again, including the child that you might think is the outlier, in a discussion about end-of-life wishes with your doctor in a doctor's office so they can get some insight into how you and a doctor are thinking about things, and they can have their technical questions answered. The outlier is a problem in the sense that they can cause difficulty for end-of-life decision making, but if one gets the entire family on board, things work out better. So you have to sort of identify the outliers and come up with a plan to get them in the fold.
I want to bring dementia in for two reasons. Number one, because you map out the causes of death after 65, and congestive heart failure tops out at 34%, and cancer at 28%, all the others in single digits. I'm glad to see low numbers for dementia as a cause of death. But Patricia Ann in Eureka also wrote in asking for us to address dementia in the context of making plans for late in life. I mean, if it's gotten past the point where they can make those plans already, then what do you do?
Well, this is a hugely sophisticated question and problem to deal with. What I recommend and what many thinkers on the subject recommend are what are called progressive advance directives, where the demented patient, prior to becoming incompetent, tells the family and puts down in writing milestones after which they will decline medical treatment. So the advance directive progresses as the disease progresses. For example, if a person, I might have my advance directive read that if I am moderately demented and can't tell what season it is and dress myself inappropriately, I want you to pronounce me a do not resuscitate patient, and I want you to decline antibiotics for pneumonia, paragraph 2. If I become severely demented and cannot recognize any family member or my children in particular for 3 weeks or 3 months, you make the call. If I cannot recognize my family member, then I want to decline all medical therapy, and I want to, I want to, you to refuse hospitalization on my behalf. I want you to refuse all medication and medical therapy on my behalf. So that's the kind of directive that progresses as the disease progresses. The problem with it is that's not universally recognized by legal systems in every jurisdiction. So that's where the sophistication comes in. But it is helpful to have that information in advance, because sympathetic caregivers, sympathetic physicians, sympathetic hospice nurses will do everything they can to follow the stipulations within the legal limits of their jurisdiction, and that might be the best you can do.
Well, you do get into voluntary refusal of food and fluids as well. Can that be part of an advanced directive? I mean, you can, you know, as you point out, you can refuse antibiotics for pneumonia and make other medical choices, but can you tell people in advance, if this happens, don't feed me, don't give me water?
I believe you can, and I believe, so the answer is, that is my belief. This is being worked through by various, by the legal system in various jurisdictions, but I believe that if you define a natural death as declining manual feeding, if you define manual feeding as a medical treatment, you can decline any medical treatment and remain ethically and morally appropriate.
Okay, so if you can't feed yourself and somebody else has to feed you, that becomes manual feeding, and that's a medical treatment.
Correct.
All right. Nora in Eugene writes, an advanced directive is something everyone should have. It is a gift to your children. Thank you for that, Nora. I want to talk about personnel for just a moment, Sam, because your father's final days had a bit of a cast of characters, the way you describe it, and I can imagine people of limited means thinking, I won't have that. I can't afford that.
Well, under those circumstances, that person will be in an institution, and which is a nursing home, for example, or a residential nursing home, and the issue is to do the best you can to choose a nursing home that is sympathetic to your end-of-life type wishes, and of course has the staff that are sympathetic to you, and it's. So a good deal of that is outside of your controls, which is why it's desirable to pass away at home if possible. But there are some things that you can do in terms of finding a nursing home that suits your needs better than others, and that might involve interviewing the nursing home, the head of nursing at that nursing home, and the head of the physician who does makes most of the decisions in that nursing home.
So spend some time there before it gets to the point where you have to be there.
Correct.
So I'm intrigued, Sam. We didn't mention that you did most of your medical practice in the greater Washington, D.C. area and treated a fair number of international patients. What differences did you notice in old-world patients from the ones who are here natively to this continent?
Well, the old-world patients usually did not come with the preconception that American medicine would fix everything. Yes, they came with the idea that American medicine was better and had much more to offer than in their homeland, but they usually came with a different perspective on cancer or heart failure, for example, and they knew that they were still going to find limitations here in the United States. I also, their families, who usually were living in the Washington area and brought their parent over for health care and then brought them to my office for a consultation, they would usually be in attendance because they would be translating, and frequently the family member would say, oh, back home we never talk about cancer, don't tell my mother or father they have cancer, they can't handle it. But in my office, based on my beliefs, I always advised them of what I thought their disease was and what I thought the circumstances were, and not a single patient collapsed or couldn't deal with it. Every patient said in their own way, I appreciate this, or thank you for bringing me up to date, and now let's move forward and make some decisions.
Mm-hmm. I'm really intrigued by a statement that actually is in the first part of the book, which is that we as a nation think that we are on the brink of a series of cures. Is this part of our difficulty in dealing with death? Is we think that what is potentially going to kill us could be cured in the next month or two?
I think so. I think we read about paradigm shifts in cancer treatment and cancer genetics and DNA studies and gene therapies. And yes, there's a role for all these, and yes, they're important in terms of research. But the diseases that account for the deaths of 90% of elderly people, chronic congestive heart failure, cancer, lung disease, stroke, diabetes, dementia, these are multifactorial diseases with multiple genes involved, we're not going to isolate a single gene that is going to fix this. And yet when a president announces a moonshot to cure cancer, we feel we landed on the moon, yes, we will cure cancer. So we have this innate optimism as Americans, and we believe in our system, but we really need a reality check.
Well, we certainly learn a lot in this book. It is called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. It's the work of Samuel Harrington, M.D. Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.